Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. The calls for Israel to stop bombing Gaza continue. At least 3,785 Palestinians have been killed. Almost 13,000 have been wounded, according to the health ministry in Gaza. Of the death toll, 1,524 were children. Amnesty International spoke to survivors and eyewitnesses, analyzed satellite imagery, and verified photos and videos to investigate air bombardments carried out by Israeli forces between October 7th and 12th, which caused horrific destruction and in some cases wiped out entire Palestinian families. Amnesty says for 16 years, Israel's illegal blockade has made Gaza the world's biggest open-air prison. The international community must act now to prevent it from becoming a giant graveyard. Several Israelis who've lost loved ones or were kidnapped by Hamas on Saturday, October 7th, are calling for an end to the violence. A number of videos are being shared on social media. Haaretz reports that earlier this week, Jerusalem police detained and fined pro-peace activists from the Standing Together organization after they displayed posters in Hebrew and Arabic stating, "Together we will get through this." On Wednesday in the U.S., Jewish activists demanding an end to the bombing and siege of Gaza in the U.S. Capitol were arrested, 400 people, according to reports. It is being called the largest Jewish protest in solidarity with Palestinians in U.S. history. There was a similar protest at the White House earlier this week where 50 people were arrested. Actions are also taking place at the offices of high-level politicians across the country. Meantime, President Biden visited Tel Aviv on Wednesday and gave an Oval Office address last night, announcing $14 billion in military aid for Israel. He called the package a, quote, unprecedented commitment to Israel's security that will sharpen Israel's military edge. Axios reports that the Pentagon plans to send Israel tens of thousands of artillery shells that had been destined for Ukraine from U.S. emergency stocks several months ago. This is according to three Israeli officials. On Tuesday, HuffPost reported that veteran State Department official Josh Paul resigned from the department over President Biden's approach to Israel-Palestine, saying he felt he had to do so because he knew he could not push for a more humane policy within the U.S. government. HuffPost also reports there is a mutiny brewing inside the State Department over Israel-Palestine policy. Morale is low, and some staffers are preparing to formally express their opposition to President Biden's approach. Joining us to talk about media coverage are two guests. Hagai Matar is an award-winning Israeli journalist and executive director of Plus 972 magazine, an independent nonprofit run by a group of Palestinian and Israeli journalists. Hi, Hagai. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Chris McGrill, a writer for The Guardian US and the author of American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. Chris has also extensively been writing about what is happening in Israel and Palestine. Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I want to ask you both a pretty big question. When we look at major media coverage of what is happening right now, 13 days into this horrific war, what are your thoughts about how the media is shaping the narrative around what is happening on the ground? Hagai, what strikes you about what you're reading in Israel and then the international media?
Well, I think it's easier to say something general about the Israeli media, which is pretty uniform at this moment and has, you know, entirely supported the bombardment campaign against Gaza following the truly atrocious attack by Hamas that murdered 1,300 Israeli civilians and soldiers, but mostly civilians, in the attack last Saturday. That response by the media just did not allow for any criticism or any kind of second thoughts or questions to be asked of where this is taking us. We've tried wars on Gaza. We've tried bombarding Gaza time and time again in the past. Where is this leading? Those questions are not being asked, and there's just full endorsement of the campaign and very little to none in terms of voices from within Gaza or any information about what's really happening in Gaza. So that's a very extreme media reality. Meanwhile, I think globally, we've seen a lot of support for Israel, which is natural following the attack last week. And I do feel that there's more and more nuance and complexity in questions being asked as time goes by. The further away we get from the initial attack, the more there's willingness to bring in voices from Gaza and criticize what is the collective punishment of cutting off 2 million people from electricity and water and fuel and supplies. There's more and more talk of that, and I think that's an important development.
Chris, what about you? What strikes you when you read the international media and then major media here in the U.S.?
Well, I think, I mean, it depends who you read and what you're watching. Some of the coverage is really very good. And it's as Haggai says, you know, there's a broad range which can, you know, express sympathy you know, for the families of the Israelis who were murdered and abducted by Hamas in what, you know, what has to be said was the most appalling attack. At the same time, it can raise the questions about not only what is happening to Palestinians in Gaza now, but the broader context of continuing occupation and oppression. And as many people have described it, entrenching of apartheid in the West Bank, in the occupied territories, and particularly under this very right-wing government under Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, I guess a few things leap out. Certainly, watching American television, there was a very heavily pro-Israel narrative, even on stations that would be considered to be relatively liberal. So take MSNBC, for instance. Palestinian Americans who appeared were very closely and questioned about Hamas, and their answers were challenged, and they weren't given much space to talk about the broader context. Whereas, for instance, Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, was given unchallenged many minutes to essentially not only describe the horror of the attack, but then to suggest that anybody who wanted to talk about the conditions in Gaza or alternatively the broader context of what's been going on over recent years was essentially a sympathizer with terrorism, was an apologist for Hamas, and that went completely unchallenged. And I think that that narrative has been pushed quite heavily in parts of the US media, but other parts have been very good about expressing, about describing what's going on. I'd add one other thing is that, you know, I was the Jerusalem correspondent for The Guardian back in the Second Intifada and was in Gaza for the 2008-2009 war. And I think what's really striking this time is the absence of foreign journalists in Gaza. They've been kept out, and it's really meant that sort of day-to-day wealth of reporting from what's going on is missing on this occasion. And that is, of course, by intent.
This is so important, Chris. And we've been surprised this hasn't gotten more attention. I mean, there's, of course, so much going on. But the Committee to Protect Journalists reports that as of today, 21 journalists have been killed, 17 Palestinian, 3 Israeli, and 1 Lebanese. 8 journalists are reported injured, 3 journalists reported missing or detained.
Yes, and I mean, it's an unfortunate reality. It's a terrible thing to say. But of course, if they had been foreign journalists, there'd be far more attention on those deaths. But it goes to show how dangerous the work is, indeed. You know, those journalists who are still there, the Palestinian journalists and other journalists from Arab countries who are able to get their stories out, to get the footage out, are doing so in incredibly difficult conditions. And there simply aren't enough of them, really, for us to get a proper picture. And also, you have to remember that, you know, the power's been cut off, the internet's been cut off, communications are extremely difficult. It is possible in parts of Gaza to pick up the Israeli cell phone signal. So it's not completely blanked out. And I assume some have satellite phones for bigger networks. But it's still very, very difficult to work, I'm sure.
What about the calls for an end to the siege and an end to the bombardment? Haggai, what are you hearing in Israel? Is this starting to come out? Because you have tweeted videos and statements from Israelis who lost loved ones and whose loved ones have been kidnapped, who are saying, I mean, some are just saying, end this war. Some are saying this has been done so many times in the past, and it just results in even more death. Are those voices being heard in Israel?
It's a little known fact that the specific area that was attacked, where most of the casualties, the Israeli casualties, live, is disproportionately leftist and progressive in terms of the Israeli demographics. It's an area where a lot of people are either just in their opinion or also in their actions. Many are, you know, peace activists, anti-occupation, anti-siege activists, human rights activists, some including some of the people who were murdered or abducted into Gaza. So I think that is relevant background to understanding that for many of these people, they've been saying for years, and they've been campaigning, saying, our neighbors are suffering in Gaza. We will never have peace or safety as long as our neighbors in Gaza are suffering. And now it's the same people or their family members, if they had been killed, were saying, this can't go on. This will never offer us security. Some of them are being interviewed here and there in Israeli media. But I have to say, again, in terms of public opinion and kind of acceptable narrative in the political discourse, there's absolutely no room for any calls for ceasefire. It's not on the table. Everyone is just expecting the promised ground invasion, which is supposed to happen at some point. They said it would happen and drafted reserve service soldiers on the very first day, which was almost 2 weeks ago. We still don't know if and when that will happen, but the common assumption and the common will of people in Israel right now is to promote, go ahead with following up on the bombardment, going into a full land invasion into Gaza. So that's where the discourse is, and very, very far from any talk of a ceasefire.
So do you have any updates on this? Because yesterday, Israeli Economy Minister Nir Barakat said that the Israeli military has the, quote, green light to move into Gaza. They said hostages and civilian casualties will be secondary to destroying Hamas, even if it takes a year.
Yeah, that's very consistent with what members of this government have been saying. While some of them pay lip service to the 200 Israeli citizens that are inside of Gaza that have been abducted, they have been making it clear that this is not a priority. There have been several attempts at negotiations with foreign countries and local diplomats trying to strike some sort of a deal, at least to release toddlers, children, some elderly people, trying to release at least some of the people that are held there. But Israel has just so far refused flat out to negotiate anything for their release. And it seems like the passion to take revenge and take a very serious toll on Gaza is much stronger than the will to release the captives. That is, I would say, the one place where there is controversy inside of Israel right now, because the families of those abducted and many others are saying, we might want revenge, we might want this military campaign, but not at the price of losing our loved ones. Our state has let down its guard and abandoned these people and caused them so much suffering. We owe it to them to bring them back home, whatever the cost, even if it means a ceasefire. So that is the one place where there's some limited discourse happening.
Today, we're talking about media coverage of the ongoing violence in Israel and Palestine. And that is Hagai Matar, an award-winning Israeli journalist and executive director of 972 Magazine, an independent nonprofit magazine run by a group of Palestinian and Israeli journalists. Chris McGreal is a writer for The Guardian US. Chris, you wrote a piece a couple of days ago called "The Language Being Used to Describe Palestinians is Genocidal." Can you talk about your piece and what you laid out?
Well, I was struck. I had covered the Rwanda genocide, and I wouldn't want to overdraw this comparison, but I did say that some of the language emerging, particularly within the United States, but also from some of prominent Israeli leaders, had that element of what we heard in Rwanda, the dehumanizing aspect, the fact that there were people who were blaming all Palestinians for Hamas's attack, dehumanizing them in general. I mean, we heard Senator Lindsey Graham saying that Gaza should be flattened, in effect should look like Tokyo and Berlin at the end of the Second World War. Another congressman, Max Miller, basically said the laws of war should be swept aside. You had former US ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, essentially saying all Palestinians were responsible for Hamas's crimes. And we had the Israeli president, Isaac Herzog. I'll read you his quote because I think it sort of reflects this. It says, he said, "It's an entire nation out there that is responsible. This rhetoric about civilians not aware, not involved, it's absolutely not true. They could have risen up. They could have fought against that evil regime." And there was quite a lot of that. I mean, Lindsey Graham also said, "We are in a religious war here. Level the place," talking about Gaza. And the editor of the Jewish Chronicle in London described Muslim culture as in the grip of a death cult. And I think what was striking to me about that language was it's about dehumanizing an entire people so that you can go and do what you want to them, so that when the numbers of ordinary Palestinian deaths rose, you essentially putting the blame onto them. And it's cast partly in the context of, you know, we need to do it to them before they do it to us, which was very much the language of the Rwandan genocide, alongside language about them not being a legitimate people, talking about the Tutsis in Rwanda, Palestinians here, that they are somehow inferior, just the kind of language that you hear when you want to dehumanize people.
Mm. Well, and speaking of that language, and then what you talked about earlier about the media, especially the cable shows, this language has consequences. And tragically, there were stories about the Palestinian American boy who was fatally stabbed near Chicago. He just celebrated his sixth birthday. His name was Wadea Al-Fayoum. According to reports, a 71-year-old stabbed this boy and his mother. I mean, this is horrific, Chris. And a number of people are also saying this, that this is just going to result in even more violence, not just in Israel-Palestine, but around the globe.
Well, I think the other, you know, one of the points that, at least on American television, that Israeli figures have made is that they're comparing it to 9/11 in the US. And of course, one of the things we got out of 9/11 was exactly that kind of rhetoric as well. And look where that led the US. And so I think, you know, this kind of language does beget violence, and we should be very careful about dehumanizing entire peoples.
Hagai, obviously, in addition to the violence in Gaza, you have also been writing about the violence in the West Bank. Can you tell us what's happening there?
Yeah, so I think, well, the world's attention and Israeli attention is drawn to Gaza. Settlers in the West Bank have very openly decided to take advantage of what's been going on and double down on their violent attacks against Palestinian communities in the West Bank. Just over the past 2 weeks, we've seen more than 60 Palestinians killed in attacks by settlers and in confrontations with the army. We've seen more than 10 Palestinian villages destroyed by settler attacks. These are communities that were coming under attacks once, twice every day by settlers setting fire to things, attacking people, and at some point just gave up because they have no defense. If they try to defend themselves, the army comes in and shoots the Palestinians who are just defending themselves from settlers attacking them in their own villages. So they felt defenseless and have left those villages. And this is a concentrated attempt to ethnic cleanse entire parts of the West Bank and ensure Jewish domination over those parts of the West Bank. And because it's, you know, the numbers of those people killed are so much smaller compared to what happened in the south of Israel and obviously to what's happening in Gaza, it's just not getting the same levels of attention. But it's quite tragic and very consequential.
Haggai 972 is an online magazine of Palestinian and Israeli writers. Where are your journalists? Do you have any journalists right now inside Gaza?
Yes, we do. We have people reporting from Gaza on a daily basis. Chris mentioned some of the challenges there before. I can tell you, you know, we have people that report while they are trying to find fresh, clean water for their family to drink, while they're running away from bombardments. One of our journalists had his home destroyed in an aerial attack by Israel shortly after they fled to call safety, and also trying to communicate with without electricity, trying to find somewhere just to charge their phones to do the reporting is really unfathomable conditions for journalists to be doing their job.
And then you mentioned the West Bank. We have a link to 972 on our website. What are your thoughts about this, given the statements from Israeli officials that Chris just repeated, Haggai? What is the end game here? I mean, how far do you think Israeli officials are planning to go, given the utter destruction that we are seeing so far in Gaza?
That's a good question. I think it's a very concerning one. That genocidal rhetoric is very much prominent in basically everything we're seeing in the media and from former generals who hold a lot of sway here and from politicians. I hope that it doesn't indicate where we really are going, but we can't rule out anything. I mean, the talk of a second Nakba is in really depopulating the entirety of Gaza, forcing people to another term as refugees, and 70% of the people in Gaza are already people who were living in refugee camps since 1948, and their children, grandchildren. So now the notion of forcing people out of Gaza and into Sinai, making them refugees again in Egypt, is something that people are discussing seriously here. I don't know if that's what's going to happen. I really hope that while President Biden and Rishi Sunak and everyone that's kind of been very, very supportive of Israel have given kind of blank checks, you know, to Israel that it can do whatever it wants, I hope that if things continue to deteriorate, they will step in and put some guardrails. But so far, it doesn't look like that. And it's really hard to say where it's going to go.
Well, to your point, Ariel Kalner, a member of the Israeli parliament for Netanyahu's Likud party, said right now one goal, Nakba, a Nakba that will overshadow the Nakba of 1948. What are your thoughts, Chris, about how far they will go given the violence that we're already seeing?
Well, like Haggai, I think it's very hard to predict. And I wonder if the Israelis themselves don't actually know. I also wonder what Joe Biden said behind the scenes to Netanyahu. He made a very public display of flying over there and showing support, but I doubt he did that just to sympathize with Netanyahu. I think he probably was pushing quite a strong message, and maybe this parade of foreign leaders going to Israel is in part about, you know, trying to delay at the very least a ground attack or to limit its intentions. But I don't know. I do think one of the interesting things about the narrative here in the press, which Haggai sort of touches on as well, which is the whole thing around what's going on in the West Bank is invisible here. It doesn't form part of the context in the press here on the whole. And I think you can see the Israeli government and its supporters. They really push a message in the press here that Gaza is separate. Gaza is unoccupied. Therefore, Gaza has nothing to complain about. Now, the United Nations would tell you differently on the question of occupation. But even if you were to take at face value that claim that Gaza isn't occupied, it is part of the broader Palestinian territories, and most of them are occupied. But there's this real attempt here, and it has taken hold quite effectively in some ways to separate Gaza out from the West Bank in the narrative and suggest that there's nothing going on.
Chris McGrill is a writer for The Guardian US. Haggai Matar is an award-winning Israeli journalist and executive director of 972 Magazine, an independent nonprofit run by a group of Palestinian and Israeli journalists. Chris and Haggai, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And you can find links to the articles that we mentioned today at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the future of the far right Republicans, the plans they have for the United States, and then also what's going to happen with the House now that Jim Jordan has lost his third bid to become House Speaker. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.